I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection for the Oregon Legislature to order Monday, May 14th. Got six Senate bills on our agenda, and we're going to start out with opening a work session on Senate Bill 605. Steve, give us a little preview, a reminder of Senate Bill 605, and did we get the amendments we were waiting for?
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 605 makes a person engaged in the business of cleaning or servicing chimneys subject to licensure as a construction contractor, and the committee has Senate Bill 605-1 amendments before you that are in your packet, and it was to address some concerns that Craig Smith of the CCB had, or Construction Contractors Board had, about how the statute could potentially redefine what a construction contractor was as written.
Thank you. And Craig, would you come up and give us a nod on this bill and explain to us what you've done to fix the ambiguity that we were left with?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, Craig Smith, Construction Contractors Board. You'll recall last week when we had the chimney sweeps here, very colorful testimony that we had. This is a small bill. What this bill does is it clarifies that people that are engaged with chimney sweeping work need to be licensed with the Construction Contractors Board. It has a slight broadening of the definition of construction contractors. The operative words are at the bottom of the paragraph number 3, where it adds, or to clean or service chimneys. That's really the heart of the bill. I had a little bit of concern with the beginning sentence as legislative council changed the definition of contractor, and the chart that I'm passing out to you is in essence a kind of a hand engrossed of what it would read if you adopted the dash one amendments. And so it would read after on paragraph 3, contractor means a person operating as a general contractor, residential only contractor, a specialty contractor, business, other person who, and then it lists all the different things. I think it reads better. I think it clarifies the definition that legislative council intended, and we would offer for your consideration the dash one amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any questions from the committee? I think this is pretty straightforward. Appreciate you catching that and helping us make sure we got this right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 605.
Representative Bonamici moves the adoption of the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 605. Any discussion? Any objection? Dash one amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Mr. Riley, would you call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Senate Bill 605, having received the required majority votes, the motion is passed. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 605 and ask if there's anyone that would like to carry this bill on the floor. Or should we put it on the consent calendar?
The man with the bright tie would like to.
I'm sure you can have some good comments about this bill. I'd appreciate it if you would carry it.
Mr. Chair, that means a lot to me. And it means a lot to me that the person that made the motion for this bill to go to the floor is a person whose name I've been practicing since the session this morning, and that would be Representative Buonamici.
I don't know how to take that, but
no, that's not right. Keep trying.
I respectfully request that the carrier work Chim Chimney into his floor seat.
Sure,
duly noted.
Thank you. With that, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 613. Steve give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 613 and where we're at with it today.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 613 requires that a written instrument assigning a mortgage show the name and address of the assignee. It was supported by the creditor-debtor section of the bar. Wasn't opposed by anyone. The amendment before you, dash one amendment.
That I do not know.
Well, the amendment before you just changes the section of statute that that the bill actually affects from, I guess, what was described to us as a procedural part of the statute to a, I can't recall the exact words that he used, but it basically it doesn't affect the bill. It's just a technical amendment to clarify, I guess, in a given court procedure that this doesn't affect the procedure, it just affects the statute.
Yeah, I think it's, if I can clarify, I think it's being moved.
To meet you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's being moved to the chapter dealing with recording requirements. And the debtor-creditor section supported the amendments.
That's how I recall it, too. Is there anybody that wishes to speak to us about this amendment or this bill? Seeing nobody jumping up. I would take a motion on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the dash bond amendments to Senate Bill 613.
Representative Bond Meachie moves the adoption of the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 613. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing or hearing none, they are so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate Bill 613 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 613 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Mr. Riley, please give the roll call, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 117, or excuse me, Senate Bill 116.
613.
Excuse me. Got dyslexia. Senate Bill 613.
That I didn't just ask.
Having received the required majority votes, is declared passed onto the floor. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 613. And is there anybody that wishes to carry this bill?
Does it seem like a likely candidate for the consent calendar?
No, because it requires a lot of explanation.
I have,
that's exactly, yeah.
I think Delici, I'd be happy to carry it if you want.
Anybody object to putting it on the consent
Delici.
Calendar? Anybody object to putting this on the consent calendar?
No? Okay.
Let's put it on the consent calendar.
Okay.
So, let's try opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 116A. Steve, give us a brief summary of Senate Bill 116A.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 116A prohibits and requires certain business practices by towers of motor vehicles.
Simple bill. Do we have anybody signed up?
And also, there are dash A3 amendments before the committee that come from, I believe, the Attorney General's office.
Okay.
116.
Could I have up Andrew Scholl, please?
Chair Holvey.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, Andrew Scholl, Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, Financial Fraud, Consumer Protection Section. Our Assistant Attorney General that has worked hard with many of the interested parties on Senate Bill 116. Unfortunately, had a court hearing conflict today that couldn't be avoided. So I am here to give you a very brief outline of what's occurring with this bill and the Dash A3 amendments. My understanding is there are plenty of folks in the room that were part of the work group and can answer more specific questions should you have them. Towing is largely an unregulated industry in Oregon. Currently, the Oregon State Police and City and County Police have some regulatory authority, particularly over certain non-preference tows. Those are tows that are requested by the police rather than the owner or driver of the vehicle. Also, the City of Portland has a city code that regulates private property impound tows, which is when a vehicle is towed from a private parking lot, presumably because it's parked where it's not supposed to be. But currently, there is no central consumer protection agency with authority to handle many of the common complaints we receive about the towing industry statewide. This is including identifying the location and phone number of the tow company who towed a vehicle, receiving accurate information about the costs of the tow, and getting an employee of the tow company to release a towed vehicle from storage. Senate Bill 116A is consensus language drafted by a working group that was set up by the Senate Committee on Commerce. This group included representatives from the legislature, the towing industry, the insurance industry, property managers and landlords, an automobile road service organization, the Oregon State Police, the City of Portland, the Department of Transportation, and the Department of Justice. Combined, the disclosure requirements set forth in Senate Bill 116A will help prevent some of the predatory practices that are often described in consumer complaints. For example, under Senate Bill 116A, a consumer will be provided basic information such as who towed his or her vehicle, where to pick up the vehicle, and how much it will cost to get the vehicle back. The bill does this in several ways. There can be more specific disclosures at the places where they were towed, large disclosure signs. In that event where somebody comes upon their vehicle being towed, it has to be provided to them in writing before the vehicle is actually driven away. And last, if the vehicle sits for a working week, 5 days or more, unclaimed, towers will request the necessary information from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and they'll then mail that information to the person who owns the car. Additionally, a consumer will be able to pick up a vehicle in the evenings and on weekends, so the days of storage will not accrue. More detailed explanations about the provisions of Senate Bill 116A are provided in written testimony, which I will provide to you shortly. I do want to touch base on the Dash A3 amendments. These are technical amendments. It fixes a technical drafting error in Senate Bill 116A dealing with when a tower can charge a gate fee to a person who wants to obtain personal property of an emergency nature from a motor vehicle that was towed. To give you a brief description, often what we see are complaints where people can't afford to immediately get their vehicle out of the impound yard, out of where it's being stored, because they can't pay all the towing fees and all the storage fees. But if you've left your prescription drugs in the car or you've left your baby carrier in the car, those are of an emergency nature. Understandably, when the business is closed, they can charge a fee in order to give you access to that personal item of an emergency nature. And the way the original Senate Bill 116A was drafted, it set forth that could occur at night and on holidays. It was intended to also include Saturday and Sunday for businesses that are closed on Saturdays and Sundays. It just was missed in the language. So it's my understanding that, again, this is a work group consensus amendment. It was intended to include weekends, and this one sentence amendment simply fixes that oversight. And with that, I thank you, and I apologize on the written testimony. I'll get it to you right now.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Scholl from the committee? Doesn't appear to be any questions. I thank you for your testimony.
Thank you very much, Chair Holden.
Next up, I have Gary Coe.
Good Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Gary Coe, and I live in Portland, Oregon. We, as you mentioned, there was a work group that the Department of Justice put together of all the interested parties. I represent the towing industry, and I think that all of the various factions that may be interested in this were in attendance. We had more than one meeting working through the details, and the result is the consensus draft that you see here. It was passed in the Senate. We in the industry would appreciate passing this as it is, as it's a very workable piece for all parties. I'll be glad to answer any questions if you have anything from the towing industry.
I have a question.
Question, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. You mentioned that you'd like us to pass this as is. Have you seen the Dash 3 amendment? And
yes.
Did you mean including the Dash 3 amendment?
Yes, please.
Okay, thank you. Some clarification. Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that would like to speak to Senate Bill 116A? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 116A and open a work session on Senate Bill 116A.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the Dash A3 amendments to Senate Bill 116.
Representative Bonamici moves that we adopt the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 116. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, they're so adopted.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 116 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 116 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
I have a quick question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we get a Senate bill and they refer to a work group, right? It's not your work group, it's the chair of the corresponding Senate chamber's work group.
I would guess it's somebody's work group. It
wasn't mine.
That's all I can tell you.
Okay, thank you.
Excuse me. Mr. Chair, in this excellent memorandum we just got, it says, the chair of the Senate Commerce Committee asked the Oregon Department of Justice to form a work group.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, there's our answer. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we have a motion on the floor, Mr. Riley.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 116A, having received the required majority votes, is moved on to the floor with a due pass recommendation. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 116A. Is there anyone who would like to carry that bill? Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No, thank you. So with that, I'd like to move on and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 117. Steve, give us a little description of Senate Bill 117, please.
Thank you, Chair Holvey. Senate Bill 117 expands the state no-call program and regulation of unlawful telephone solicitations to include all telephone customers of telecommunications companies.
Thank you. And we have a committee. It looks like we have a Dash 1 amendment. Can you tell us anything about this Dash 1 amendment?
Only that the person who brought the Dash 1 amendment to the committee has now indicated on the sign-up sheet that he withdraws the Dash 1 amendment. He does not withdraw the Dash 1 amendment.
We never liked it anyway.
Okay.
With Dash 1 amendments. Sorry.
Oh, we we've always liked them.
Dash doesn't say withdraw.
This is a great committee today.
Let's get the perspective.
No more Mother's Day holiday. Excuse me.
Can we have up Peter Shepherd and Andrew Scholl, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Peter Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General, and I'm joined by Assistant Attorney General Andrew Scholl. Senate Bill 117 presents a straightforward proposition for your consideration. Framed as a debater's resolution, it would be resolved that the Oregon Attorney General should be empowered effectively to enforce the choice that approximately 1.6 million Oregonians have made to list their telephone numbers on the federal no-call registry. The Attorney General and Senate Bill 117 stand on the affirmative side of that proposition, and the status quo and the Dash 1 amendments, which apparently had been withdrawn and then resubmitted, stand on the negative of that proposition. In 1999, with Attorney General Meyer's support, the Legislative Assembly adopted the state no-call statute. When it was adopted, Oregon joined just a small number of states that had similar statutes. We were one of the first in the nation to have such a statute. It was effective, cost-free to taxpayers, and vigorously enforced by the Attorney General. We believed then and continue to believe today that the no-call law is constitutionally enacted and constitutionally enforced. Subsequently, the federal government established its own list. In 2003, the federal government effectively preempted the state law. In sum, unless we changed our state law to permit our list to be shared or mirrored in the federal list, then we were effectively forbidden by the law to enforce effectively that choice that Oregonians had made to list their names on the federal list. Since that date, since we were effectively preempted, Oregon's no-call enforcement effectively has had no teeth. Senate Bill 117 would cure that problem. Let me briefly address the Dash 1 amendments, and then Mr. Scholl and I would stand by for questions. The Dash 1 amendments, as I say, stand on the negative side of the proposition that I've proposed for you. They are effectively the text of a bill introduced and considered last session, Senate Bill 208A. There are three reasons why the Dash 1 amendments stand on the negative side of the proposition rather than on the affirmative. First, the Dash 1 amendments are more likely to be declared unconstitutional than is the printed bill. This is so because one of the tests under the Oregon Constitution for the constitutionality of a statute or the kind of challenge that we might expect to the Senate Bill 117 is a challenge under Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, a part of the Constitution guaranteeing and prohibiting the enactment of laws that restrain or restrict free expression. One of the tests that the Oregon Supreme Court has laid down for us in applying that is whether the law addresses itself to the harms that are caused by a given activity that is sought to be prohibited, rather than to the expression itself. And the findings make clear in Senate Bill 117 the harms to which this law is addressed. Those findings do not appear in the Dash 1 amendments, and thus it is more vulnerable to constitutional attack than is the printed bill. Second, the Dash 1 amendments are more likely to be ineffective in attacking the worst violators of no-call prohibitions. And the reason for that is that under the Dash 1 amendments, we would effectively have no access to civil penalties, whereas under the printed bill, the Attorney General has access to civil penalties under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And let me be clear about what I mean by access to the civil penalties. It is not that the Attorney General unilaterally can impose a civil penalty under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It is rather that at the end of the process, if a person violates an agreement that the person has entered into to obey a given trade regulation or law enforced by the Attorney General, then one of the consequences under state law for that subsequent violation is the imposition of a civil penalty. So it is not that the Attorney General unilaterally has authority to impose a civil penalty, but rather that is a potential remedy for a violation of state law. whereas under the Dash 1 amendments, such civil penalty is not accessible to the Attorney General. And third, the third reason that the Dash 1 amendments stand on the negative side of the proposition rather than on the affirmative with the printed bill and the Attorney General is that the Dash 1 amendments really set up a situation that's fundamentally unfair to businesses who might inadvertently violate the no-call prohibition by placing a call to a consumer had listed the consumer's telephone number on the no-call list. And the reason I say it's unfair is that under the State Consumer Practices and Unlawful Trade Practices Act, we have the authority, before we ever accuse a business of violating our law, to inquire of the business in an enforceable way through a civil investigative demand to explain to us what the circumstances are that caused what seems on its face to be a violation of law. It's a tool that we use to determine, in effect, to sort the wheat from the chaff in terms of complaints that we may receive, to determine in the first instance whether what looks like a complaint that may have a basis in law can be substantiated, and even beyond that, to get an idea of the maliciousness of the violation of the complaint so as to appropriately calibrate our enforcement response to that complaint. Under the Dash 1 amendments, we would not have such ready access to civil investigative demands to the extent we were enforcing the matter in federal court. So as to those objections, we suggest that the Dash 1 amendments stand on the negative of the proposition. It's our suggestion to you that if it is your desire that the Attorney General have be empowered to effectively enforce the choice that approximately 1.6 million Oregonians have made to list their telephone numbers on the federal no-call registry, then we ask you to join the Attorney General on the affirmative side and support Senate Bill 117 as printed. With that, I'd stand open for questions.
Thank you. Anything to add, Mr. Scholl?
Chair Holvey, I'm just here for support. So
thank you. Thank you. Question, Representative Galizio.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the cross-examination period begins to the first affirmative. This is very exciting. So we have the plan and the counterplan. So to the plan. could you, Mr. Shepard, elaborate a little bit more on the problem in the status quo in terms of, you said the federal law in 03 preempted the state law. I'm sure those who passed the law would say we created uniformity in a better system. So if you could just talk a little bit about more about that and why it's a problem. And then secondly, when you said Oregon's law since 2003 has no teeth. So just more about the problems with the status quo.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, I'll ask Mr. Scholl to respond to the first question as to the preemptive effect of the federal, effective preemptive effect of the federal law.
Mr. Chair. When I did debate, you weren't allowed to tag team cross examination. But if you're going to allow that, okay.
Chair Holvey, Representative Galizio, I think the assertion you made for the folks that passed the federal legislation is correct. What occurred in Oregon is the way our list was set up and the way our list was created and what list we could use was set by statute, by our statute. Without the appropriate amendments to our statute, we simply couldn't use the federal list or the Oregon portions of the federal list to enforce our Oregon no-call law. So one of the reasons we use the term effective preemption is the preemption has occurred because we can't mirror the list, the federal registry, and we can't use the federal registry. But if the appropriate amendment were made to Oregon state law to allow us to use that portion of the federal registry that covers Oregon to enforce our state law, then that effective preemption would dissipate.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure this is really pertinent, but I'm just curious how these lists are handled. For example, in 2001, we found that the DMV was selling lists for $800 and ultimately, you know, wrote a law that its people now can opt on their list instead of off, when I don't think they should have that right. So what do you do about these groups selling these lists? I mean, can our electric company sell their list and
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, short answer is no. The consumers, this is an opt-in program, so consumers must affirmatively list their telephone numbers. Once the number is listed, I'm more familiar with the structure of the state statute since I was involved in 1999 with structuring that, and we went to great lengths to make sure that that list couldn't be used for any inappropriate purpose, and perhaps Mr. Shull has a fuller answer.
Chair Holby, Representative Nelson, I would just add to that that unlike certain lists that we've heard about in the past that have made it to the public domain, these are registries essentially of telephone numbers, not any personally identifying data, et cetera, that may exist in what we think of as normal lists of consumers.
Representative Galizio, did you get the second half of your question answered about the status quo? I'm tag teaming with you here.
Well, I think it was implied when you said it has no teeth because of the way it's structured at the federal and the way that Oregon, we didn't amend it, so that, I think so, but I don't know, maybe there's something to add.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, on my debate team, there were two identical twins, and we could never tell which one was actually answering the question. So, the statute is effectively unenforceable, and I think the record demonstrates that's so. There have been something around, we think, something around 15 enforcement actions by the Federal Trade Commission since the preemption occurred, 15 nationally. And none under Oregon law. We can't effectively go into federal court because we don't have the pre-litigation discovery tool that I described, the civil investigative tool, and we don't have the power of the civil penalty at the end of that case if it's necessary for a particularly egregious violation. And so that's why we say no teeth, and in fact the record bears that out. There have been very little enforcement of this on behalf of Oregonians since preemption occurred.
Thank you. Representative Gerard.
Oh, thank you, Chair. The question I have is, this had a fair amount of opposition on the Senate side, and it was my understanding that there was kind of some gestures made that it would be fixed on the House side, but if you do without the -1 amendment, I don't see any of the fix. And the second question I have is, the legislature is actually supposed to make the policy, and the Attorney General is supposed to enforce that policy. So why are you having a coronary over the -1?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, first, I don't think any representative of the Attorney General's office indicated to anywhere in the Senate process that we thought there were amendments that ought to be entertained here. And we, in fact, spoke to the Senate committee about Senate Bill 208, which is the 2005 articulation of the -1 amendments, and described to that committee why we thought those were not as desirable an option as the printed bill in the Senate committee. I think that it's a pretty straightforward proposition, and we, for the reasons explained, don't judge the -1 amendments to represent a viable option to Senate Bill 117. I'm not sure if I can be more elaborate any more, help you any more with your question, but they do not provide us with the tools necessary for us effectively to enforce the choice that Oregonians have made.
Can I have a follow-up with that?
Follow-up.
Well, if the -1s don't do it, is there anything short of this bill that we can do to make this a better bill that would address some of the concerns that were addressed in the -1s? I don't think everything's written in stone with the -1s, but can we make this a better bill with some amendments that would help the different people that are for the -1s?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, I'd be interested in hearing the argument for the -1s, and certainly the Attorney General would never close his ears to a suggestion about how to improve a measure. I can tell you that the -1s certainly do not improve the printed bill, and this is very old territory for us. We've been engaged in the discussions around what a better policy option to the current no teeth, no call status quo is for really since preemption in 2003. We've had many, many hours of discussion with people about the way to attack that problem. We're not unwilling to talk with people. We never have been. And indeed, over the years that we've tried to restore effective enforcement, we've spent a lot of time talking with folks. And Senate Bill 117 is the best option that we can see to bring forward to you at this point.
Further questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Shepard, Mr. Scholl, for being here. So currently, if you want to bring an enforcement action, you need to do it in federal court under enforcing the federal law, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that's correct.
Okay, and follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Can you talk about what's happened in other states where, and I'm looking at the Attorney General's letter here, where in Missouri, for example, they've enacted their state law to avoid the federal preemption, and I can understand why you don't want to wait for FTC enforcement, with all due respect to my former employer. So how is it working in other states where they have enacted similar provisions allowing avoiding the preemption?
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, the Missouri example that we gave you is probably one of the best. It's working very well. Not only does it allow an attorney general to go into state court where that might be more appropriate and to enforce the state law, it doesn't foreclose action in federal court under federal law if the facts of a case happen to require that or if the facts of a case would make that a superior option. And what states like Missouri have been able to do is actively enforce it and not lose any of that benefit from the limited number of federal enforcements and add to it a relatively large number of state actions in order to protect their consumers.
And one more question, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you. I noticed that in the Attorney General's letter, the FTC received 15,000 no-call complaints just last year. Do you know if those tend to be from one particular business or industry, or are they just spread out among many different callers?
Chair Holby, Representative Bonamici, it's a pretty wide spectrum of industries and consumer complainants.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here. Having been involved in sales in a prior life, some of the language in this concerns me. I don't think I'd go stronger than that, but I wondered if you could comment on it. To me, I certainly understand and support the idea of stopping the harassment and nature of these calls. I understand wanting to protect the most vulnerable of our society from this kind of thing. But when you look at wording, specifically that concerns me on the first line of the, or first page of the bill, and you lump in, I'm looking at line 12, practice of cold calling, which is the initiation of calls to parties with whom the telephone solicitors have no prior business relationship, then it just keeps going to market scams, fraudulent schemes, and worthless goods. Maybe I'm, you know, splitting hairs, but I don't think those all belong together. Cold calling can be annoying to us, but cold calling, you know, how else do you get a relationship if you're starting a business if you have no clients? So I'm wondering about that, and then the other one you can comment on if you'd like is on the second page, the first line. It says prevent legitimate telephone calls, and I wonder, you know, who makes that determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I'll start the answer, and then Mr. Scholl may want to add to it. The findings in this bill are drawn, as I understand it, from the corresponding findings made by the United States Congress in enacting the federal no-call authorization statute. And so to the extent that there's a particular framing of one of the findings or not, I think that's reflective, really, of picking up the conclusions that Congress arrived at after its study of the problem and its articulation of its purposes. And so we borrowed that language in effect. To be clear, these findings do not themselves establish the standard or unlawful trade practices. That is to say, the Attorney General's Office, if Senate Bill 117 becomes law, wouldn't be engaged in determining what call was a quote, legitimate telephone call as defined in line one on page two of the bill, or an illegitimate call, because that's not an operational standard for enforcement. The question for enforcement would be, was there a call that penetrated to a telephone number that was on the list or not? Okay. So I hope that eases some of your concern about the particular phrasing of the findings.
Chair Holvey, Representative Gilliam, I would simply add that it's correct that much of the findings came from the congressional findings attached with the federal bill. Much of the findings come from our experience in the almost 4 years that it was enforced, and none of them are meant to be all-inclusive. They set up independent categories, one being fraud, another one being cost shifting, another one being the invasion of privacy issue that Congress in particular focused on. So if it's being interpreted to say all cold calls are existing for fraud, that's not its intent.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Thank you. That's helpful. I have to say I'm more comforted by your explanation than I am that it comes from Congress. But I just have that concern that those are not lumped together and that somehow somebody, God forbid if you go back to these kind of sales, but somebody that is, you know, trying to make a legitimate call for a legitimate purpose, trying to find business, is somehow lumped immediately. Annoying, yes, but immediately lumped into market scams was my concern.
And Chair Holvey, if I may, Representative Gilliam also, at the end of those findings, to make clear that those various categories aren't all inclusive, they specifically talk about that the purpose of it is to prevent the harmful effects set forth in subsection 1B of this section, but not to impose an unnecessary burden on legitimate telephone solicitations and telephone solicitations that would otherwise be in compliance with the law.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question. How does a business person who might be making cold calls, how do they know if someone's on the list? Where does the list exist? How do I get it?
Chair Holvey, Representative Riley, underneath the federal program, there's great websites available both through the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, and the Federal Communications Commission, and it's lumped into help for consumers and help for businesses, and it tells you where to access the list and how to go about applying for the list if you're a business looking to telemarket. One of the reasons we like the way the Federal Registry is set up is because businesses get a certain amount of area codes for free. So Oregon businesses that are only telemarketing in Oregon would be able to come by this list currently at no cost to them, essentially. The first five area codes are free, and then you pay a fixed amount after that, up to a total for, I believe the current is approximately $17,000 for the nation.
I guess I do have a follow-up.
Thank
you. And if this bill passes and you get to do more toothy enforcement, then would when you first contact a business, would that be a time when you would say, you know, do you know how to get this list? Do you know what you're do you know how to do what you were asking you to do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Riley, I think that the short answer is that if we were to receive, you know, one complaint about a business, the most likely response would be an inquiry that says something effective. Don't you know we have a no-call list, and here's where to go to get it. And that raises a bigger point question that lurks behind the debate about this bill is the exercise of enforcement discretion for the Attorney General, because there's no denying the fact that, and indeed it's an argument we suggest for the bill, not an argument against it, that Senate Bill 117 would empower the Attorney General to have some very strong enforcement tools. And the question is whether those tools will be used with discretion and fairness and in a way that's calibrated to the magnitude of the violation. And I suggest to you that's the way in which we did enforce the no-call law when we had these tools previously, and that's what we would propose to do again. And on that point, and I guess in kind of in closing on that issue, one significant advantage in having the Attorney General back engaged in the enforcement of the no-call law is precisely because the Attorney General is, after all, accountable to the people of Oregon for the exercise of his discretion, whereas the Federal Trade Commission, for all their merits, is, I would suggest, not so accountable.
Thank you.
Further questions? I've got just one. Seeing as how there was 15,000 complaints in 2006 attributed to Oregon, could you reiterate how many of those that you know of that the FTC actually followed up on as far as looking into the complaint or settling it? And the second part of that question is, does the Department of Justice have the staff to look at 15,000 complaints per year? Not suggesting that the federal government does. I'm just kind of curious where you're at.
Chair Holvey, I'll take the first question and let the deputy answer the second question, since he's far more familiar with the overarching staff setup at our office. The 15,000 complaints that go to the Federal Trade Commission or to the federal program are treated in an internal database. They are essentially compiled for data for the federal government, and then the federal government takes actions on those that are national in scope or egregious or otherwise a federal priority. The numbers have been updated a little bit. As of the last report to Congress, they had filed the Federal Trade Commission had filed some 28 actions, of which 21 had successful settlements, but that was as of the report, which was September of 2006. And the Federal Communications Commission has also taken a handful of actions. So in terms of how they're dealing with it, they look at it in it's my understanding they look at it in terms of broad data factors. I mean, when they see a problem in those complaint datas, that's what they focus on and investigate. Our program did handle the large volume of complaints, and staff people reviewed those complaints at some level. So there is definitely a more personal touch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we can't identify any individual enforcement action that the federal government has taken on the basis of complaints from Oregonians. It seems likely that there probably are some of those Oregonians who complained, whose complaints were part otherwise of some kind of a national pattern that the federal government was enforcing, but we can't trace the federal action to any individual complaint from Oregon of any of those complaints. As to the staffing question, we have had and will continue to have forever, I suspect, many more matters in our consumer protection unit to deal with than we have resources to handle. In part, that reflects, that's just the reality of the work there. So it's a constant matter of triaging complaints to determine where the most egregious problems are and where we can let things go with relatively less harm in the marketplace. So we've submitted a fiscal impact statement on this bill that indicates that there would be no fiscal impact, because what we would do is shift resources to the most egregious patterns of no-call complaints and address those with our existing enforcement resources, there's a cost for that, of course, and that is that we wouldn't be doing enforcement in some other manner, because we'll have to triage those matters and not do those other complaints. But that's why there's no fiscal on this bill.
Thank
you. I don't want to ask a question. I just want to clarify, the FTC does not represent individuals, and they won't pursue an individual complaint They only bring an action if they can show that it's in the public interest. So it has to be a pretty big, wide scope, and it's a difficult standard to meet. So if I can understand why we haven't seen much enforcement of our Oregon that affects Oregonians. And I think the closest office is still in Seattle. Is there still a Seattle regional office? But probably not a lot of enforcement out of that.
Thank you. Representative Girard.
Oh, thank you, Chair. The question I have stems from some existing language, and since we're redoing the bill, I got a little bit of a question on this. Page 3, line 10, which really basically exempts politicians from making unwanted phone calls. I was kind of curious why, if you've examined that, during the last election, I know a lot of people got unwanted text messaging, push-pull polls, and we're pretty notorious for being out there on the complaint list. Is there any reason that you exempted politicians from the no-call list?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that, as you correctly point out, is a feature of existing law. And the Attorney General hasn't proposed and hasn't asked that be changed. That's certainly something that would be a policy choice that you might choose to make, and it wouldn't change the our enforcement effort of the bill, or wouldn't change our assessment of the bill.
Further questions?
I do have a question. Can I ask a question? Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a different standard applied to political speech under either the First Amendment or Article 1, Section 8?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, under the First Amendment, the answer to your question is yes. The United States Supreme Court has distinguished between different categories of speech in terms of the way it reviews restrictions on speech. Under Article 1, Section 8, the answer is no. That's the Oregon Constitution. The Oregon Supreme Court has to date not distinguished between, for example, commercial speech and political speech. Eliminating line 10 might expose this to some form of attack under the First Amendment. But it wouldn't change the analysis, I don't think, for our purposes of Article 1, Section 8.
Further questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would either one of you could reveal your house district that you live in?
You don't need to answer that.
Let's see if they got the call.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I live in South Salem, and I'm a regular voter.
You withdraw the question.
Chair Holby, Representative Gilliam, I am a proud resident of Canby.
Representative Riley, do you have any comments about phone solicitations in political arenas?
Yeah, not at this time.
Okay, I check. With that, seeing no further questions, thank you, gentlemen, for your in-depth look at Senate Bill 117. Next up, I'd like to have Paul Cosgrove, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing Oregon Financial Services Association, and sort of the designated discusser from a business perspective, at least in some part, on the no-call bill. I was never on the debate team, so I may need to call on you and other members of your committee for appropriate procedure, but I'd like to start by rejecting the proposition that you got from Mr. Shepard. In other words, we agree on that proposition, and it's the piece of summary of my testimony that's coming out starts with, there's no disagreement that we would like the AG to do effective and aggressive enforcement of no-call law. There is a considerable disagreement about how best to accomplish that result, and we think the Dash 1 amendment does that better for reasons I'll discuss. And one of the primary goalposts is that with the passage of the federal law in 2003, the business community, those responsible telemarketers who try to comply, don't make calls to people who are on no-call lists. prefer uniformity in terms of what the standards are. However, we are happy to have the Attorney General get back of Oregon, get back into the enforcement of no-call, and the Dashboard amendments do that. Federal law, when it was passed in 2003, said there will be one list, the federal list, so we no longer have an Oregon list. And that was beneficial to consumers for a variety of reasons. The federal list was free. Oregon's list, we charged a small amount. The second beneficial thing about the federal list was, as Mr. Shepard or Mr. Scholl mentioned, it's more accessible to businesses. You can get up to, I think he's correct, 5 area codes of no-call list numbers for free so that you can make sure you're not calling people. The third benefit is the federal list, where Oregon's didn't cover cell phones, the federal list did. And where Oregon didn't cover business telephone lines, the federal list did. So we all appreciate the federal list. We also appreciated the fact that the standards by which you would determine whether you were meeting the law, like whether you were making a business-to-business call, which is permitted under Oregon's law and under the federal law, and some of those other things, would be done uniformly, nationally, so that when we're training people who are making calls into various states, they know what the rules are and can follow them. What the federal law also expressly did, and this may be the reason it's not been much of an issue in other states, is that the federal law expressly allows our attorney general and every other attorney general to sue to enforce it. We don't have to wait for the FTC. If we were waiting for the FTC, we'd all be waiting a very long time. Our attorney general doesn't use that for a couple of reasons and hasn't used that since 2003. One, our attorney general would prefer to be in state court rather than federal court. The Dash 1 amendments address that. Our attorney general doesn't get any funding from this body except for the fees and penalties and the payments under assurances of voluntary compliance to do any of his consumer protection activities, no call or otherwise, and we've addressed that in the funding issue in the Dash 1 amendments. So we are proposing that the Dash 1 amendments actually address in a very elegant way, I believe, and simple way, making practical what federal law allows, which is having our attorney general enforce the federal law in state court if he chooses, using assurances of voluntary compliance so he doesn't have to file a lawsuit if he chooses, giving all the rights and remedies for consumers for damages and restitution to the Attorney General to ask for in state court that the Attorney General can now ask for in federal court. And finally, preserving that uniformity and interpretation that we appreciate. Let me give you one example why the uniformity and interpretation is very important to us. And my personal bank is the Bank of America. I've been with them for years. They've changed names. They've merged. And in fact, when I became a Bank of America customer, they were the bank located in San Francisco with that great big tower. They are no longer that bank. They are, in fact, a Charlotte, North Carolina bank that bought the Bank of America and took its name. Now, that's perfectly good business. It happens all the time. Wells Fargo is no longer a San Francisco bank. It is a Minneapolis bank that bought Wells Fargo and decided Wells Fargo was a better name and took the name. A couple of sessions ago, before the federal preemption, we had run into a problem where there's always been an exception under state law, and there still is under federal law, that you can call your own customers if you have a customer relationship. And we said, we have these situations. Bank of America is technically a different bank, has the same name, has the same customers. And we were unable to get a policy determination out of the Attorney General. We asked for rulemaking and weren't able to get that out of the Attorney General. We came to this body and had to pass a bill in order to provide that the customers of the Bank of America, now a Charlotte, North Carolina bank, can be deemed the customers of the old San Francisco Bank of America with the same name. And the language that you see in existing Senate Bill 117 on page 3, lines 19 through 24, was what we had to amend in Oregon's law in order to get that very rational, we believe, and appropriate construction of Oregon's law. If we have only one law, the federal law, and the Attorney General is enforcing the federal law, we don't have that problem with a different interpretation of who is a predecessor, who is a former customer, that we did several years ago in Oregon. So that's just one example of why the consistency of one law, one list, is important to us, although we completely agree that we shouldn't wait for the FTC to enforce. The Attorney General ought to be given the tools to go to state court to get an assurance of voluntary compliance if they don't want to file a lawsuit, which we think is appropriate, and to, if they do file a lawsuit, get their investigative costs, the damages and restitution for consumers, and their attorney's fees. All of that is accomplished in the Dash 1 amendments, and that's why we support them. A bit of history. Last session, the Dash 1 amendments were amended into what that bill, the bill last session, Senate Bill 208, started in exactly the same place as Senate Bill 117. I think it's a word-for-word identical bill. And it was amended by the Senate and passed overwhelmingly. I think we had one no vote on the floor as a better method to address this problem. Now, it didn't get adopted by House action. It came over here relatively late in the session. However, we still think that that's the better way to go, and none of the concerns about constitutionality or effective remedy that were being made here today by Mr. Shepard were considered, all of them were considered last session, and all of them were considered to be addressed by what you're seeing in the Dash 1 amendment. So we would propose that that is a better solution. It's better for business. The more consistency we can have, the more ability we will have for the good businesses who want to follow the law to in fact make sure they do follow the law and yet still give the Attorney General the enforcement authority that he would seek. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cosgrove, Mr. Shepard and Mr. Shule talked about the finding section of the bill and how that would help the bill, if enacted, withstand constitutional challenge. And is it my understanding that your amendments take the findings out? And how does that affect the if there's a challenge, constitutional challenge to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, yes, our amendments take the findings out. The findings are, in our view, unnecessary if you're enforcing federal law, which has withstood that kind of challenge. And frankly, I appreciate Hardy Meyer's letter to you. He mentions the constitutionality issue, and he concludes in his letter on page 2 about someone trying to raise a no-call unconstitutionality argument by saying such an argument would, as to the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, be frivolous today. And I think that he goes on to talk about the Section 1, Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution as well. I think that's a pretty clear place where we are as well. We don't think if you're enforcing the federal law, you don't need the findings. And even if you didn't have the findings in federal law, frankly, I agree with the Attorney General's view on the constitutionality of the no-call law. No one has challenged it, to the best of my knowledge, on a constitutional basis.
Thank you. Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Chair. Following up on constitutionality, you heard my arguments about line 10 of page 3 dealing with the exemption for politicians. You wouldn't have a problem if we would amend that section of the bill. Obviously, that wouldn't impact you at all, would it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gerard, it wouldn't impact my clients. It would impact me, and frankly, I wouldn't mind it. I'm on every no-call list, have been when we had a state law and when we had a federal law, and I only get calls from charities, which I am willing to accept, and from political calls, frankly.
But you're not willing to accept, I assume?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rodd, do I have to answer that one? I always accept calls from politicians, Representative Riley. Happily. During dinner.
Well, that was a close call.
It was. Thank you for saving me, Mr. Chairman.
Further questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All joking aside, which that was, one of the things that I always hear from people is that, gee, we only want one law covering us for the whole country, which is, to me, code for I don't like stricter laws than that. And so I tend not to take that very seriously. I think the Oregonians deserve to have us represent them with what we believe are the right laws and not always take what the federal government says as the right way, because I don't always believe it is. So with that argument gone, what other reason can we have for the Dash 1 amendments?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, first, before that argument goes away, let me try to address it. The changes in Senate Bill 117 proposed to reinvigorate our law are to make it exactly identical to the federal law, so that, in fact, the differences between Oregon law and federal law, if 117 without being amended is adopted, do not exist, unless, of course, we get to interpretations of the kind I mentioned, which I think do cause problems for us, and we came back to address those. We would prefer to have one set of guiding principles. If the law is the same, we'd like to have it interpreted the same in every state. So it's not a matter of the law being more protective by any means. There'll be identical laws. It's the matter of, do we have multiple interpreters of the law?
Excuse me. By that, do you mean because we will have federal court and or Oregon court? Is that what you're referring to when you say multiple interpreters, or is that the Attorney General's interpretation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, it's the Attorney General's interpretation. Obviously, any time you have multiple courts, the potential for a different court decision always exists, right? One judge to another judge. But no, I'm talking about the different basic interpretation of the law as pursuing cases. Okay. So I'd rather not give that argument away, because I think it shouldn't be given away in this case. The laws are intended to be, and in fact have to be under federal law, the same. We agree that the enforcement given to the Attorney General under federal law is not enough just to let the Attorney General go to federal court. So our Dash 1 say, yes, let the Attorney General go to state court and use the state court remedies. And frankly, when they get penalties and other damages that aren't going to consumers, because the court can order damages to consumers, which of course the Attorney General wouldn't keep, those other damages and their investigative costs and their attorney's fees go to the Attorney General's budget, which in fact funds the program. So we think we've addressed all the legitimate concerns for the Attorney General.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Polizio.
Mr. Cosgrove, one argument that was made was that the Dash 1 amendment's unfair to businesses who place a call by accident and under UTP, or the unlawful trade practices, they have the authority to inquire of businesses in the civil demand. So what about that argument?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Galizio, the Attorney General always has the authority to write a letter to ask if you know about a law, and in fact they do that now. I don't think that's a very powerful argument. It's available remedy that the Attorney General has, regardless of whether you're in the Dash Ones or not. And it's been my experience representing clients that, in fact, that is, generally speaking, absent a horrendous pattern of conduct, exactly what the Attorney General does in all the consumer protection areas of the laws of the state, is write a letter to ask information, give me your side of the story, because obviously they get complaints that says somebody did something wrong to me, and they need to know what the other side of the story is before they decide, is it a valid complaint? Was the person complaining mistaken? Was the business mistaken? Who was mistaken? So that's their normal course of conduct and would still be available to them under the 117-1 amendments.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification, is it your understanding that under the Dash 1 amendments, the Attorney General could not use the civil investigative demand or impose civil penalties?
The civil investigative, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, the civil investigative demand isn't specifically mentioned in the Dash 1 amendments. If that were a problem, we could easily do so. We drafted them last session and then redrafted them exactly the same this session to try to give the Attorney General all the tools the Attorney General had. Your second question was on penalties.
Civil penalties?
The court has the authority to give investigative costs, attorney's fees, damages, and restitution. I've always interpreted that to be equivalent to civil penalties. But again, if that's a concern, that's an easily fixed one. Thank you, sir.
Easily remedied.
Further questions for Mr. Cosgrove? Seeing no further questions this time, thank you for your testimony. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 117? Seeing yet again no one jumping up, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 117 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 561A. Steve, give us a brief review of 561A.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 561A allows a tenant to cause a repair of minor defect in a dwelling unit if the landlord fails to repair the defect in a timely manner after the tenant gives proper notice.
Thank you. I'd like to have up Norton Cabell and Sybil Hebb.
Chairman Holby, members of the committee, my name is Norton Cabell. I live in Eugene. I'm a legislative director of Oregon Rental Housing Association, and I'm delighted to have the opportunity to testify before you on behalf of Senate Bill 561, which I might add passed the Senate Commerce Committee and the full Senate unanimously, both times. For the last 10 or 12 years, I've also been a member of the General Landlord Tenant Coalition, a group that's been in existence for, I think, now about 25 years, and that negotiates changes to landlord-tenant law. The primary players in this coalition are the Oregon Rental Housing Association, of which I'm the legislative director, Multifamily Housing Council of Oregon, and Metro Multifamily Housing Association, those three statewide landlord trade groups. And on the other side, the Community Alliance of Tenants, a tenant advocacy group in Portland, and the Oregon Law Center, with Sybil Hebb here as the, she'll tell you her title, I'm not quite sure, and the Lane County Law and Advocacy Center. Our history has been to look for solutions to landlord-tenant law to protect good tenants from bad landlords and good landlords from bad tenants. We work on a consensus basis, so the coalition bills that we bring you have the support of all the players. I've provided you written testimony that covers the section by section of this bill, which covers much more than just the original introduction. But I think today it's worth just talking about two of those sections, and I'll talk about one and Sybil the other. The first has to do, as the title of the bill does, what's popularly called repair and deduct. This provision allows a tenant whose landlord is not responding to written requests for repairs to have the repair made and to deduct the cost from the rent. There's been a provision in Oregon landlord-tenant law covering this subject, I think, since the law was adopted in the 70s. But it's very difficult to use. It has more than a dozen elements in it, and if the tenant fails on just one of those, then the tenant fails. This usually happens in FUD eviction court, and so failing on one particular element means that the tenant ends up being evicted. It is very rarely used because it's so complex. Most legal aid lawyers that I know recommend tenants don't use it. So we've tried to fix this to make the process easier to use. We've limited it to only minor habitability repairs that cost no more than $300 to fix. We'd honestly like a piece of the law that works as opposed to the current section, which we believe doesn't work.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb from the Oregon Law Center, and I'm here also in support of Senate Bill 561A. As a representative of the Oregon Law Center, which, as many of you know, is a statewide nonprofit law firm representing low-income Oregonians in civil matters, we are at the coalition table on behalf of tenants' interests from a statewide perspective, and we have been a member of the coalition for a long time. We are particularly excited about about the second major section of this bill, which Mr. Cabell referred to, which relates to protections for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault. And these provisions do sort of two bulk things. And one is that they expand on and clarify some of the current protections in Oregon law passed two sessions ago, which allow victims of domestic and sexual violence to terminate leases early if they need to do so in order to avoid a safety threat. And the bill provides some clarifications around definitions as to who is eligible and also expands the types of proof that victims may use in order to show that they are eligible for this relief. The other sort of major section of these protections that are in the bill are passed or are we've come up with as a response to the recent changes made in federal law by the Violence Against Women Act, which was first passed federally in 1994 and then is reauthorized every couple of years. And in 2005, it was reauthorized to contain some important new protections for victims of domestic violence in housing that is funded by Congress. So any Section 8 housing and public housing authority housing in Oregon is now governed by these protections in federal law, which provide that victims of domestic violence may not be discriminated against on the basis of the fact that they were a victim, and also provides that landlords may, in a new form of relief, bifurcate a lease so that they could evict a person who's been a perpetrator without also evicting the rest of the household when that household is the victim of the abuse. And so the provisions that are in Senate Bill 561A implement those same protections, but for both public and private housing. So we're very pleased to have these changes moving forward and hope that the committee will be supportive. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Pretty straightforward. Any questions from the committee? I'm not seeing any questions. Thank you very much for your public testimony today. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 561A? Again, seeing no one jump up, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 561A. And open a work session on Senate Bill 561A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 561A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 561A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, Mr. Riley, please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 561A, having received the majority votes necessary, the motion is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I have to close the work session on Senate Bill 561A, and would anyone like to volunteer to carry this bill on the floor? Sure. Representative Nelson, it is yours. Thank you for volunteering. Next up, I have Senate Bill 894. I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 894A. Steve, give us a brief description of this.
Thank you, Chair Holby. Senate Bill 894A allows the PUC Public Utilities Commission to adopt rules to conform Universal Service Fund to the federal law and related rules to the extent that the Commission determines it's appropriate.
Thank you, and it's my understanding Senator Devlin is on the way, so we're going to stand, this committee is going to stand at ease. House Committee on Consumer Protection back to order and reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 894A. And Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's okay, I'll bring up a couple of parties with me that may be helpful if you have any additional questions. I can probably answer the first level, but they can probably answer the second, third, fourth, and fifth levels. So, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 894, that implements a consensus recommendation of the SB 17 Task Force on Telecommunications Law Revision. This bill passed by a vote of 29-0 with one member excused in the Senate. The bill authorizes the Public Utility Commission to adopt rules to conform Oregon's Universal Service Fund to the 1996 Telecommunications Act and FCC-related rules. It also authorizes the PUC to, if necessary, change Oregon's Universal Service Funding by rule to match the Federal Communications Commission. This rulemaking authority for the PUC is very narrow and focused on conformance with the Federal Communication Universal Service rules. The purpose of universal service funding is to ensure that basic telephone service is available at reasonable and affordable rates in areas of the state that are costly to serve. The FCC currently funds federal universal service programs by imposing a percentage surcharge on retail, interstate, and international telecommunications revenues. The FCC does this by rule because the 1996 Telecommunication Act does not specify a particular funding mechanism. In contrast, however, Oregon's method of funding its universal service program is established in law. Currently, Oregon's statutory funding mechanism, a percentage surcharge on Oregon and retail telecommunications revenue, closely matches the FCC's. However, that may change. The FCC is seriously considering replacing the current funding mechanism with a fixed surcharge on each telephone number. If the FCC makes this change under current law, the PUC would not have authority to mirror the FCC approach. Instead, they would have to continue using a percentage surcharge on revenues. This dual system would be difficult for both the telecommunications industry and the Commission to manage. This bill fulfills the SB 17 Task Force recommendations that the law be changed to grant the PUC narrow authority to adopt rules that would modify Oregon's funding mechanism and conform to the FCC. There is no opposition to this bill, either that I can identify in this building or outside the building, and as I indicated, it passed by the Senate by a vote of 29-0. I might also comment, that for those of you that many of you might be aware, that the SB 17 Task Force on Telecommunications met throughout the previous biennium, and I was the co-chair along with Senator Nelson, and also on the committee were Representatives Butler and Rosenbaum. We discussed practically every aspect of telecommunications that any of you might want to discuss or may not want to discuss. We came to agreement on only two relatively small changes in telecommunications law. This is one of them.
Thank you, Senator, and it's good to note there is no opposition to that you're aware of, but it hasn't made it through this committee yet, and this committee is pretty famous for opposition. So
famous opposition?
So with that, I think I'm going to go ahead and does anybody have any specific questions for Senator Devlin? Not hearing any.
Can I just ask one, please, since I haven't asked a question today? Or did I ask one?
Yeah, you have asked one.
Oh, can I just have two questions,
okay,
please,
more.
For
one
today?
More.
Thank you. I just really...
prearranged that or something.
Oh,
Good idea.
Yes, thank you. Senator Devlin, is this something that all the other states do?
Well, I think it would be better for maybe Mr. Willis to comment on that, but my guess is they probably have different mechanisms. Some of them probably do not have their own universal service funds. Some probably do. We do because of the vast rural nature of this state and the necessity of having some funding at the local level. If you ever wanted to get into a broad, prolonged discussion, you'd start talking about federal universal service and how where the money goes doesn't necessarily depend upon the need, but on the seniority of the member of Congress that happens to have control over the money.
Boy, are we going to set something similar up?
Yeah.
Well, I think we'll go ahead and hear from the Public Utility Commissioner representative.
Mr. Chair, representatives, members of the committee, Rick Willis, Executive Director with the Public Utility Commission. Not much to add to Senator Devlin's testimony. The commission participated in the SB 17 task force and supports this bill and believes that the commission needs latitude to be able to change the Universal Service Fund should the FCC do it. As Senator Devlin mentioned, that right now we're in sync with the FCC, which is a bit of a scary thought, but at the moment we are. what they are, the FCC is seriously considering changing their methodology, and if they do, we're kind of stuck where we are with a different method. And that doesn't help anyone, either the telecommunications industry or the regulators. So this bill would give us the latitude to be able to change with them if that's needed. So we would ask your support.
Thank you. Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association, along with Senator Devlin and others. I was a member of the task force. As such, I was the chairman of the subcommittee that dealt with the Universal Service Fund issues, and I felt that's some responsibility to come here and support the bill. We do support the bill regardless, and also to make myself available to answer any questions if the committee had any.
Questions from the committee? Here we have Universal Service Fund. Any questions? It doesn't appear that we have any questions. I think the senator gave us a pretty explanatory version of the bill. And as such, I want to thank you both, all of you, for bringing this bill forward and appearing before us to help us understand it. With that, I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Is no one else has signed up for Senate Bill 894A? Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 894A? Seeing no one yet again jumping up, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 894A and open a work session on Senate Bill 894A.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 894A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves Senate Bill 894A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
I think Mr.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, despite... Oh, I'm sorry.
Representative Galizio.
I was going to say, despite the damage that the Telecommunications Act did to radio in this country, I'll still be supportive of this bill. I'm serious, actually.
That's what's weird. Yeah.
Well,
any other any other discussion?
No.
Is there another comment on that? I don't understand that.
I hear none.
I think it's an
Mr. Riley, would you call the roll, please?
Aye. Mr. Chair, I will vote on this measure.
That's good.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 894A, having received majority votes necessary, the motion is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, this seems like a very likely candidate for the consent calendar.
Here, here.
And I have a suggestion that it be put on the consent calendar. Any objections to that? Then that's what will happen. Senate Bill 894A, I'd like to close the work session. Next up, for any of you wondering, we are carrying over Senate Bill 117 to Wednesday. And with that, I would think we dealt with everything else. I will close the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Thank you.